Welcome back to the program. Today, as the president ponders the next step in the war in Afghanistan, he's getting advice from all sides, those who seek a wider war and more troops, and those who seek less troops and more negotiation. Such was the scenario for almost 50 years of the Cold War. Presidents from FDR to George H.W. Bush would seek advice on U.S. foreign policy, and two men personify the scope and nature of that advice. One, George Kennan, was the architect of the policy of containment which guided U.S. policy for many of those 50 years. The other, Paul Nitze, advised strength and led the fight for the buildup of the American military in response to the Soviet challenge. In the end, who was right and who was wrong? And perhaps more importantly, what can we learn today from this debate and from the two men that conducted it? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Nicholas Thompson. He's an editor at Wired Magazine, a fellow at the New American Foundation. He's written articles for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Vanity Fair. And he's the author of a fascinating new book entitled The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. Nicholas Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
It's fascinating that we can look at the 50-year history of the Cold War through the ideas and the policies of these two men. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was what drew me to the project. Paul Nitze is my grandfather, so I, of course, knew about his role. But through talking to him and talking to my father and then looking at the obituaries when they both died at the same time, I realized, my God, these two men were there at the beginning, they were there at the end, and in between, they argued about everything, and yet they stayed friends. It's amazing. It's a little bit like Jefferson and Adams on a smaller scale, and so I was drawn immensely to the project because of their longevity and because of their friendship.
And the other part of it is, of course, that it is so different from today, where we see that the policy differences between people in administrations, in government, really divide them in ways that go far beyond just the policy.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an era where people shout, "You lie," at the president. I mean, part of the difference with Nitze and Kennan is that neither of them was partisan. Neither of them identified either with the Democratic or Republican Party. They both were highly individual men who felt like they could act on their own. And that had the great advantage that they never sort of got tied into a group where the other side becomes an enemy or a target or someone you dislike. The disadvantage, of course, is that neither of them ultimately achieved their top ambitions. And my grandfather, for example, worked for every president from Roosevelt to Bush, but was fired or demoted by Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Bush. Really only Reagan and Truman worked.
Right. And talk a little bit about Kennan and the arc of his career and the degree to which being an outsider and being kind of a policy wonk really held up his career.
Well, absolutely. So he starts, you know, when the Cold War begins at the end of World War II, he's on the inside. He, you know, he works in the embassy in Moscow. He writes something called the Long Telegram, which many of us read in college, and it's the document that lays out that says, look, Stalin is not our friend. We need to actually push back against him. He writes another article that says we need to contain the Soviet Union. He then becomes the top policy planner for Dean Acheson and Harry Truman, and he sets American policy between 1945 and 1949. He plays a big role in that. He helps write the Marshall Plan. He's involved in everything of consequence in those 4 years. But then he can't handle it. He's sort of a moody, distempered guy. He has a hard time working with others. He likes to be on his own. He doesn't work in a bureaucracy. And so he leaves in 1949, and he comes back briefly during the Korean War. He becomes ambassador twice, but sort of bombs out both times. And really, he spends the next 40 years as an outside dissenter. He's writing books. He writes articles. He testifies before Congress. And he's incredibly eloquent, and he's brilliant, and he sees what's going wrong with the arms race, and he sees the problems. He sees very early what's wrong with Vietnam and how we're misreading that situation, and he gets so much right. But he really can't ever work on the inside, and so he ultimately has a very different kind of influence from Paul Nitze, who is involved in all of these administrations, sort of second-tier positions in the Defense and State Department, working the bureaucracy and manipulating policy.
How much, though, of Nitze's influence came from the fact that he had so much support inside the Pentagon?
Oh, tons. I mean, that's why. I mean, the great debate, the debate that sort of encapsulates the difference between these two men is in the fall of 1949, actually, you know, 60 years ago last week, Harry Truman announces that the Soviet Union has an atomic bomb. So suddenly the arms race begins. We no longer have an atomic monopoly. Truman's question is, okay, are we going to build a hydrogen bomb? So he goes to his two top planners, Nitze and Kennan. Nitze is actually serving as Kennan's deputy at this point. And they act in two very different ways to get their arguments across. Kennan sequesters himself in a room, and he writes this beautiful 79-page paper about what will happen if we have an arms race. NHTSA, you know, joins every committee. He works with this guy. He works with that guy. He tries to push this guy out. He manipulates Acheson. And ultimately, Kennan ends up with this beautiful paper, which foresees so much. And it's, you know, amazing to read even now. NHTSA, you know, there's no document that NHTSA writes, but NHTSA wins. He has much more influence, and ultimately his side prevails, and we get a hydrogen bomb and we get an arms race.
One of the things that is so fascinating about this story is that you can't help, no matter where you were in the debate at the time, that when you look back on it and you look back at both of these men, in so many ways they were both right and both wrong.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are moments where Kennan is just profoundly wrong. I mean, in his view on democracy and his view on America and his view on cultural diversity, is just, it's sometimes appalling. You know, I call him the dove, but as I mentioned in the beginning, it sometimes he seems like a pterodactyl, right? He's a very complicated man with very deep, brooding feelings. NHTSA, you know, so right. He does so many honorable things. He's so virtuous. Every time he's not down, he stands up. He's always fighting for what he believes in. But he also grossly overestimates the Soviet power, and grossly it sees far too much danger lurking than there actually is. You know, we now know from Soviet documents and Soviet archives that they did not have the military might that NHTSA thought they did, and they did not have the evil intentions that NHTSA thought they did. So there are a lot of moments where NHTSA's just wrong. You know, he's working through all the right principles, but he's wrong.
And yet many of his ideas and many of the things that he brought to bear in terms of the strength of the U.S. military also helped in the Cold War.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. No, and he, I mean, who was right in the debate in 1949? Should we have built that hydrogen bomb? Was it NHTSA or Kennan who was right? Now, you can say Kennan was right because we did have an arms race, just as he foresaw, and we did waste a ton of money. But the Soviets were going to build a hydrogen bomb. I mean, the man running the Soviet Union was Joseph Stalin. There's a note in Andrei Sakharov's memoirs where he says, what would we have done if the United States didn't build a hydrogen bomb? We would have thought, what a bunch of fools they are, built them and threatened them. So NHTSA was correct at many, many moments. And his technical understanding of Americans' nuclear weaponry, you know, what exactly would this weapon do, and would it give us strength or would it not give us strength, was utterly brilliant. And he had an amazing mind and incredible grasp of detail. And it's also important to remember that during the 1980s, in the Reagan administration, he's their top arms negotiator, and he actually works very hard then. He's the man trying to get the big treaties, to get the big deals, to resolve this quagmire that he has helped to create.
Well, you tell the story of what he did and how close he came at Reykjavik.
Oh, absolutely, and that's an amazing story. I mean, Reykjavik is the, you know, NHTSA's been negotiating since 1970. Reykjavik's in 1986. For 16 years, he sort of stared across these conference tables of the Soviets and pushed for an inch here or an inch there and fought over technical details and language. And finally, at Reykjavik, everything is on the table. And the Soviet Union agrees to basically everything he's wanted for 16 years. And he ends up, he pulls an all-nighter. You know, he's 79 years old. He stays up all night negotiating. He comes in the morning. He wakes up George Shultz, the Secretary of State, at 7 a.m. and says, this is the most fun I've ever had. We're almost there. And then it goes to the final moments, and it's Reagan and Gorbachev in a room, and they're trying to settle, and they're trying to agree on a few technical questions about missile defense and whether it should be confined to laboratories or whether it should not. Very sort of minute issues on one big issue, and they can't reach an agreement, and the deal falls down. And NHTSA is just utterly crushed. His life's work. He felt like he was there, and there's a photograph I have in my book that shows my grandfather sitting there with Reagan, with his, you know, NHTSA has his head in his hands, and he's just, he feels awful. He gets a press conference, and he breaks down in tears, and he says, we tried, my God, we really tried. I mean, he felt this viscerally, and he desperately wanted a deal.
And there was a sense of him wanting the deal that was not unlike the idea of Nixon to China. It was only somebody that had been the kind of hawk that NHTSA had been that could have brokered this kind of deal with credibility.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and even NHTSA had a hard time maintaining his credibility with the far right. NHTSA had a lot of enemies throughout his career, and despite being the hawk, the man who undermined him, you know, Strom Thurmond, was constantly undermined, the very conservative Carolina senator. So NHTSA, it was like NHTSA, Nixon to China. When he was named Reagan's chief arms negotiator, the left was just in an uproar, and people said things like, it's like putting Pope John Paul in charge of abortion rights. And they felt it was just this terrible mismatch, this man who always wanted more weapons. Why should he negotiate the treaties? But the people who knew NHTSA really well said, you know what? Reagan's smart. This guy knows how to get a deal, and anyone can get a deal with the Soviets now, it's Paul NHTSA.
One of the fascinating backroom stories that you tell is the rivalry between NHTSA and Kissinger during the Nixon administration.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating, yeah. During the administration, so first of all, on the SALT negotiations, which happened in 1970 and 1972, the SALT I negotiations, NHTSA believes that Kissinger is undermining him, and he believes that Kissinger is acting in a devious way, and he believes that Kissinger is claiming credit he doesn't deserve, and he believes that Kissinger doesn't actually understand the details of arms control. And he's partially right on all of these, partially wrong. Then a few years later, there's a fascinating incident, which I got sort of halfway to the bottom to, but could never completely resolve. NHTSA's best friend is a fellow named Bud Zumwalt, who's the chief naval officer, and he's running for the Senate. He hates Kissinger and, you know, criticizing Kissinger all the time. In March of 76, a phone call comes to Zumwalt, and Zumwalt has reason to believe it's somebody who knows Kissinger or is on his staff based on previous phone calls and previous messages. And the man says, hey, you should know that on at least two occasions, Kissinger has said to Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin that an accident should happen to Bud Zumwalt. Now, I know this phone call happened. You know, we've got records of it here, and we talked to people right afterwards. We don't know if it came, where it came from, what it meant, whether it was, you know, it could have been the KGB. There are all sorts of things it could have been. It could have been somebody trying to sow confusion. But the consequence for my book is that Zumwalt tells NHTSA, and my grandfather becomes convinced that Kissinger isn't just a man trying to gain fame, and isn't just a man who's undermining America's position in arms negotiations. He's a man who may actually have devious intentions for one of Paul NHTSA's best friends. So suddenly, they really are at each other's necks. And there's quite a fight between Kissinger and NHTSA. Though ultimately, you know, later on, they find themselves on the same side and they become friends again.
Even after one of Zumwalt's children had been followed by security people that they thought that Kissinger had set up.
Right, and that's, I talked to Zumwalt's children, and they're utterly convinced that one of Zumwalt's children was definitely followed by somebody who worked for the federal government in some capacity for reasons that no one knows. And they told me that Zumwalt had talked to people in the FBI and figured out that the person had been sent by Kissinger to track Zumwalt's wife, had crossed up and followed Zumwalt's children, and the idea was to get blackmail information against Zumwalt. So there's a real sense from the Zumwalt family that Kissinger was up to no good at all.
Talk a little bit about the early days of the Cold War and how Eisenhower saw these two men.
Well, Eisenhower didn't have much use for either of them. So Eisenhower comes in and he's running this campaign that instead of containing the Soviet Union, we need to roll them back. And both, and not only that, instead of you know, having a sort of a complicated arms race with different tiered, you know, if they do this, we'll do that, we should respond to everything they do with massive retaliation. And so if they step across a faint line, we're going to blow them to pieces. NHTSA and Kissinger, and NHTSA and Kennan say, this is insane, right? We don't want to roll them back. We don't want a war. And massive retaliation is the stupidest policy ever. I mean, we're really going to blow them up if they, you know, do something small in Angola? No, we won't. So they'll do something small in Angola. And we'll be in this totally perilous position where our words cannot match our deeds. So they're both well, Kennan particularly is very critical of Eisenhower. He makes a speech in January of 1953, so right before Eisenhower comes into office, criticizing the new policy. Not a good idea for somebody who wants a job in the administration. I found Kennan's FBI file, and in it there's a note. After Kennan's speech, this man has murdered himself politically. So Kennan was basically a dead goose from that moment on. He does come back and advise slightly. He does work for the CIA through the 50s quietly, but he doesn't have a chance of being a top advisor. NHTSA, who ran the policy planning staff under Truman, desperately wants to stay and desperately wants to run the policy planning staff under Eisenhower, but he has sort of the same issues. And not only is he, he runs into this problem that I mentioned before. The far right doesn't trust him. And so in spring of 1953, when Eisenhower's been in office for 6 months, there's some negative stories that run in the Washington Times, and NHTSA's forced out. And so he spends the rest of the Eisenhower years trying to undermine the president and criticizing him as weak. So at first he criticizes him for being too strong or too aggressive, and then he spends the rest of the time criticizing him for being too weak.
And Eisenhower was also suspicious of him as part of Eisenhower's perception of the military-industrial complex.
NHTSA's got two problems here. One, associated with the military-industrial complex. Two, he's a Harvard grad in a bow tie who is not trusted by many of the Republican senators.
Talk a little bit about Vietnam and the views that these two men had about Vietnam.
Kennan's views are very clear. So early on, he says, look, we should not be in Vietnam. There is no connection between the Russians and the Vietnamese. And not only that, the people of Vietnam have always hated the people of China. This is a nationalist movement, not a communist movement. Not only that, we're going to end up wasting a lot of money, and we're going to look foolish in the eyes of the world. He gives congressional testimony in February 1966, so very early on in the period of criticism, on national TV, and it's incredible reading it now. It's just beautiful and articulate. So his position is very clear and totally accurate. He sees it all. Kivitsa, early on, he's working for Kennedy, and he thinks, you know what, maybe we should go in there. That's kind of far away, and I don't know how much it matters. So 61 through 63, he's a critic. 63 through 67, he's Secretary of the Navy. So these are his troops. And he actually then starts becoming more supportive of the war. And he thinks, you know what, if we have 100,000 more troops or 200,000 more troops, I think we can do it. And he's still questioning it. He still thinks that General Westmoreland is lying about the strength of the Viet Cong. And he has issues, but he ultimately is on the side of the government. 1967, he becomes the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and here he turns against the war. He says, look, okay, we've blown it. This is not working. We cannot put in more troops. It's distracting us from what matters, which is the Soviet Union. And so he plays a very important role, particularly in 1968, in turning Secretary of Defense Clifford against the war, which then has an effect on Lyndon Johnson, which gets Lyndon Johnson to limit the number of troops that we send in the spring of 1968. So NHTSA, despite being pro-war in the middle, has a very important anti-war moment at the end.
Would NHTSA have been against the war earlier if he hadn't been co-opted by McNamara?
I think so. I mean, co-opted or convinced. I mean, McNamara was an intimidating, very smart man, and in some ways he was particularly intimidating for smart for NHTSA. NHTSA was a numbers man, a quick-thinking guy who worked through logic chains. McNamara was like that, except better, quicker, faster. You know, NHTSA is sort of the human calculator, McNamara is the human computer. And so I think NHTSA was sort of awed and distressed by McNamara, and they had a very precarious working relationship. And there's a time where NHTSA goes to Vietnam, he comes back and says, this isn't working. And there's this fantastic dialogue between him and McNamara, where McNamara says, okay, it's not working. And what happens if we pull out? Do you think the Soviets will test us somewhere else? And NHTSA says, well, they probably will. And McNamara says, do you know where? And NHTSA says, no, I don't. And McNamara says, can you be confident that it will be a place where we have even less of these, where we have even less leverage and possibilities than we do in Vietnam? And NHTSA says, no, we don't. So McNamara then says, you leave me no alternative, rolls his eyes, and that's that. And so McNamara defeats NHTSA in a logic chain argument. And I think that was tough on NHTSA.
Mm-hmm. Their relationship also had this incredible story that you talk about during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. Well, the incredible thing during the Cuban Missile Crisis, this is a great thing about reporting this book. Paul Nitz is my grandfather, so I went to the Paul H. Nitz School of Advanced International Studies to look at some of his papers. And one day I went in, and you know, the papers I was familiar with were on the sixth floor, and there's a janitor, and he says, oh, I say, I've got to go see the Nitz papers. He doesn't really speak English. And so he says, okay, hold on. Takes me to the elevator, presses 4. I think, that's strange. Takes me down this long hallway, take a right, and we open it, and then there's a huge blue boiler. And behind the boiler are 60 boxes. And inside those boxes are these never-before-revealed documents of my grandfather's handwritten notes from the Cuban Missile Crisis. So suddenly I have hundreds of pages of notes that no one's seen from this incredible moment in American history, as well as all the letters my great-grandmother wrote to NHTSA and so on. One document that sticks out, which involves McNamara, is a note, a lunchtime meeting. NHTSA and McNamara have lunch during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they're talking about strategies. And one thing that one of them proposes is, quote, provoke an attack, end quote. So I don't know. Is that McNamara? Is that NHTSA? One of them was thinking, you know what, maybe we should get the Cubans to shoot down a plane. Then we can use that to maybe start the war.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about both of their views with respect to the Soviet Union.
Well, so Kennan's views very early on are, look, we need to be very wary of the Soviet Union. We need to be very careful. We certainly cannot trust Stalin. So this is why he comes up with the theory of containment. But in Kennan's view, a whole lot shifts when Stalin dies. So he's the man, he's the hardest opponent of the Soviet Union from 1945 through 1948. Up until 1952, he's still incredibly critical and very wary of them. Stalin dies in 1953, and from then on, Kennan's views start to shift. By the 1970s, he believes, look, this is a communist regime. Kennan had lived in Russia during the 1930s. He knows that communism is a terrible system. He knows that horrible things happen here. So he at once has no business with them, doesn't like them at all. But he also doesn't think they're planning to invade the United States. He says, look, guys, relax. These are a bunch of old conservative men who run this country. They don't want to invade Europe. They don't want to take over the United States. We certainly don't want to take over them. Let's calm down here, people. NHTSA constantly believes that the Soviet Union has very aggressive intentions towards the United States. It constantly believes that the Soviet Union is building up its weapons because it wants to take over Western Europe. He always uses these chess metaphors. He believes that nuclear weapons are the queens. The queens will help the Soviet Union take the pawns. He's very interested in positioning, and he constantly believes that the Soviet Union is thinking the way he is, strategically planning and plotting and thinking, what can we do here? So they have very different views. The other thing about Kennan's view, which is incredibly important and incredibly interesting, In the X article, the document he writes in 1947, he says that the Soviet Union contains within itself the seeds of its own destruction. This is a failed, fatally flawed system. If we contain it, if we keep it in a box, it will destroy itself. So that we don't need to invade it, we just need to wait. And that's the premise of containment. And he says, in fact, it could turn overnight from one of the strongest countries in the world to a totally pitiless society. And then that happens in 1989, 1990. Suddenly the Soviet Union implodes just the way that Kennan said it would. And so a lot of people say, oh, Kennan, the great sage, he's the man who foretold what would happen. And that's a very important moment in Kennan's life. So Kennan is then, after being this great dissident for 40 years, he's lauded as the man who predicted it and got everything right, and he's, you know, given a standing ovation in Congress. His response is, okay, yeah, maybe I got everything right, but guys, if you'd taken my advice in the middle, this wouldn't have gone on so long, and we wouldn't have wasted so much money.
How did they both view, both Kennan and Nitze, the end of the Cold War? Because the fascinating thing is also that they both lived long enough to see it.
Oh, absolutely. Nitze was very proud. He believed that that the United States had succeeded, that it had set the right policies, that it had followed the right policies, and things had worked out just the way they should have. Kennan was obviously pleased the Cold War had ended, pleased that this was over and we no longer were going to spend as much money on our nuclear weaponry. But he also believed that it had gone on much further than it should have. There's a wonderful interview where Nitze is asked, you know, in 1989, he's asked, why did we win the Cold War? And he said, well, basically we won the Cold War because George Kennan came up with the right ideas and then I made them practical.
Did they remain friends to the end?
To the very end, absolutely, yeah. What inspired this book was a letter my grandfather received in 1999. So my grandfather is 92, Kennan is 95. And my grandfather writes an op-ed in the New York Times saying, you know what, we needed our nuclear weapons during the Cold War. We don't need them now. Let's get rid of them. We shouldn't abandon our whole nuclear arsenal. Kennan writes him a letter, and he says, you know, dear Paul, I read your op-ed in the New York Times today, and I have to say, I agreed with every word. Isn't it nice that after 50 years of disagreeing on everything, we find ourselves in complete accord on matters of such consequence? And it's a lovely, beautiful letter. I remember my grandfather reading it out loud, and that was what planted the seed for this book.
Talk a little bit about the criticism that your grandfather came under for allegedly having pro-Nazi sympathies.
Well, so my grandfather's great uncle actually had worked with the German government against the Americans and actually helped mastermind a terrorist attack in Black Tom Harbor to blow up American munition supplies. So my grandfather's of German origin, and not just of German origin that had been aligned with the German government at a time where we were at war with them. So the Second World War comes around, and there are questions about my grandfather's mother and whether she is a Nazi sympathizer, and then there's an FBI tail put on her. And then my grandfather allegedly says some pro-Nazi things at a dinner party. So he's under FBI scrutiny. And when he actually comes to Washington for the first time, he'd been a banker on Wall Street, he can't work on the government payroll because he's being investigated. And so he has to sort of work without government pay for the first year until he's cleared. You know, they call all his friends. They call James Forrestal, and Forrestal, there's a great note in his FBI file where Forrestal says, look, Nitze may have said something. He says stuff at dinner parties, whatever. This man does not have a drop of pro-Nazi sympathy in his body. Let me hire him.
How did he react? How did Nitze react to that, to these criticisms?
I think it made him both outwardly and inwardly more pro-American. I mean, he was an incredible patriot, is something I learned, you know, through childhood, through my mother. He believed passionately that the United States had the best system, that the rest of the world should try to be like the United States, and that one should devote their lives to the best interests of the United States. And anybody who was a spy or anybody who, had done things to the detriment of this country would have just the most incredible wrath for. So I think, and that was probably partly from those questions that were raised early in his life.
Talk a little bit about how both of them saw what was taking place in this country in the 1960s.
Well, they both thought it was disastrous. Kennan is a dove. You might think he would have been sympathetic with the student protesters. He thought they were unhygienic, drug-addled fools who didn't understand anything about the way the world really worked. Nitze thought they were undermining American position and that actually, you know, he and the other good people in government would come up with the right policy. So Kennan actually writes devastating essays criticizing the students, and Nitze works on a secret organization to try to undermine them.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, was that because both of them saw themselves as the establishment that was threatened by all of this?
Yes. I'm not sure whether they saw themselves as the establishment that was threatened. That's part of it. but I don't think it was all based on self-preservation. It was also partly based on a sense that this was a break not just with establishment, but with sort of all the structures that held America together.
Talk a little bit about that. What was it that they saw that was threatened?
Well, for Kennan, it's the bonds between, you know, father, son, and the connections that go back for generations, right? So you've had people founded this country as they sowed the fields. You know, Kennan has writes a book in his later years about his ancestors going back 10 generations in Wisconsin. And suddenly there are these people saying, you know, get rid of our parents, down with the state, down with these people. And Kennan says, wait a second, you know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, we're in this together. We shouldn't be trying to destroy it. And in fact, Kennan actually believes that these people are the, you know, the successors to Trotsky, Stalin, and the Soviet Russian revolutionaries in, you know, 1917. And Nietzsche, I think, feels it does not as strongly. Nietzsche is sort of proud. Nietzsche's kids are a little bit connected to these people. Kennan's kids are a little more deeply. Kennan is incredibly disappointed in his children for protesting. Nietzsche, slightly less so, but I think they're coming from the same place.
And in many ways, what they saw was the underpinnings of the system that had allowed America to operate for so long coming undone.
I think that's right.
Nicholas Thompson, the book is The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. It's just published by Holt. Nicholas, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I've got readings this Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And on Wednesday, I'm in Corte Madera at Book Passage at 7 o'clock. On Thursday, I'm in San Francisco at Borders. And on Friday, I'm in Palo Alto at Books Incorporated.
Well, we'll look forward to all of those. Nicholas Thompson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me here.